Hello there, my friends, and welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, Administrator, and it's a beautiful day outside today in Austin, Texas. For those of you who aren't in Austin, I feel bad for you because you're missing out. It's about 74 degrees. And our guest today, only one guest on the Weekend Interview Show this week, and our guest is Linda Schrock-Taylor. She writes for LouRockwell.com and is a government school special ed teacher and also owns and operates something called the Learning Clinic. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I'm glad we could finally arrange to get this thing going.
Yes, I am too.
Okay, well, let's start right there with that intro. You teach in government school, and yet you also own your own little private school or some sort of little teaching institution. So which is better and why?
Well, I can make remediation changes much faster at my clinic. I have a little learning clinic where I remediate reading, math. I teach reading from scratch, any age. And I am finding that with a one-on-one basis, I can make repairs so quickly, whereas in the government schools, and probably in most schools, you're assigned a class with the children having a variety of needs, and trying to be all to every child at the same time slows the process down so badly, and then with the wrong procedures and methods that have been used in schooling, whereas in a clinic setting, I can teach a person to read in about 30 hours. I can remediate in about 12 hours of instruction. And in our government schools, we're having our children sit there for 10, 12 years and graduate not even able to read their diplomas.
So first of all, it's a problem of class size, and then second is the curriculum?
It's not so much the class size, it's that the needs of the children are so varied, and so it's hard to do so many things at once. And in special ed, I'm getting the children from the whole language curriculum, which has been proven to be a disaster. A friend and I will even be speaking in near Detroit in May on studies that have been done on how whole language causes brain damage. So then to try to undo the damage that structurally has happened in the brain and try to remediate the skills and try to fill in all the gaps in knowledge that have occurred during all those years when the children were not getting an education becomes an impossible task.
The whole language method of teaching people to read has, I guess, been quite a controversy for some time now. I read something somewhere that said that it was originally invented by a minister to teach deaf mutes how to read, because after all, a deaf mute can't sound something out. They just pretty much have to memorize the shape of the word and go from there, right?
Yes, you're exactly right. a couple of our American educators were visiting schools for the deaf in Europe, and they observed a classroom where a teacher was teaching deaf children to read. No one felt deaf children were ever capable of doing anything. And so, kind of in this natural movement, but not stopping to think of the whole ramification of the decision, they said, well, if this method can even teach deaf children to read, it must be wonderful for everyone. I'm a trained teacher of the deaf and taught the deaf for many, many years, and it is the only option for the deaf because, like you said, they do not store any words in their head auditorily. So when we sound out a word, we hear the sounds in our mind, or we sound the word out loud, and then it rings a bell, and yeah, I know that word. But a deaf child can sound it right out, but it won't mean anything because they don't have it stored in a sound category. And so our children who have all been forced into this system now for all of these years have just bombed out. And I heard a percentage lately that they think it may be 68% of the population damaged to have gone through whole language. And when I was a girl, it was considered California, Michigan, and Iowa were the three top education states. And the last I knew, I think California, this would have been about 5 years ago, California was testing just ahead of Guam.
Oh, nice.
Yep.
And you think that the whole language is really the root of that problem, that method of teaching reading?
Yes, because we could almost only teach reading, and then the rest would take care of itself. You know, if everyone read well, they would become more curious and read and almost educate themselves. But when everything breaks down at the reading level, then the child is just totally crippled on having any skills and any plan for being able to continue towards gaining an education. And the whole language does not teach kids to read. It teaches them to recognize the shapes of words and try to memorize those. Now, the human brain, speaking of it like in computer terms, has enough RAM to get you, remember enough words to get you to about mid to high third grade reading level, which is very interesting because most deaf individuals finish school with a mid to high third grade reading level. And past that, you have to be able to sound out words in order to keep growing and deal with higher level vocabulary.
There's something to the idea that, you know, the shape of words can be a real big key. I mean, in fact, there was an email going around not too long ago that demonstrated that if you keep the first and the last letter of each word the same, and you scramble keep the first and last letter of each word and scramble all the rest of the letters on the inside, that you can read a whole paragraph like that. And it becomes quite apparent what it is, as long as you keep the letters at the beginning and the end in the right place.
Well, I had that email arrive also, and my students and I had an interesting discussion about it. They had difficulty reading it because they were not good readers, and so they could not anticipate what that scrambled word probably would mean in that position in that sentence. And so I think if we tried that on a broad population, we would find that those of us who read well, yes, you can scramble those and we still can keep up with it pretty well. And those who don't read well still will not be able to read that passage.
Right. It's sort of like the recognizing the shape is sort of an after effect of learning how to sound it out. Once you read well all the time, then you just get used to the shape of the word. But it's just a matter of putting the cart before the horse, right?
Right. When whole language began, the people thought that they would watch good readers read, and they would see that our eyes would leap from word to word to word, and they thought we read word by word by word. And so then they thought, well, we just have everybody memorize a bunch of words, and then they can just read word by word by word. Now that they have the ability to have computers track the eyes, they've learned that good readers only look at a word long enough to realize what it is, and then they leap to the next word. They don't go ahead and sound out stop all over again when they know the word stop, and they say SD, and they move right on. And so we need to teach children to be able to decode, to be able to code swiftly and automatically, and then it's like the words on the page become transparent, and you're looking through the words into the meaning. It's such fun to watch that happen in a child. I had a girl, I'd had her for about 2 years in my classroom. In her senior year, I assigned a book report, and she came in one day just breathless. She said, "Mrs. Taylor, something was really strange." I said, "What?" She said, "Well, my book is about a bookshop and a pet shop." And she said, "I forgot completely that I was at home. I was in the pet shop with everything happening." I said, "Well, because you've crossed over the line now to being a reader, and you're going past the words, entering the story, and into the meaning." And it's I watch for that key moment to happen for each of the children.
Yeah, that must be really rewarding, too, when they notice exactly when that moment happened to point it out to you.
Yes, they just become breathless. Because they've always had to struggle, and it's never come easy for them.
You write often in your columns that little kids just love the idea of learning how to read, that they just are giggly with excitement, and that very quickly they learn to hate learning to read. Why is that?
Well, when they watch their parents, hopefully they have parents who read at home and set models, it looks easy to them. And you ask any little child, you know, "Why do you want to go to school?" "Learn to read. I want to learn to read." That's what they want. I remember as a child, I just couldn't wait to learn to read. And so they go in with high hopes and anticipation that soon they will be able to pick up a book and read like mom and dad. Then the school uses whole language. They find out that it's not easy to learn to read that way, and then they start seeing themselves as a failure, and the disappointment sets in, and the self criticism, until then they don't want anything to do with reading because their heart's desire was there and it was demolished.
Yeah, I actually went to a school where they taught phonics, and I had really good teachers as far as government school teachers go. And I remember, I guess, in first grade where they divided us all into groups of boats and bears and whoever, where the... And I think I was in the second group, the second most advanced group or whatever. And I remember thinking, like, hey, I can read just as good as Jason. Why is he in the top group and I'm stuck behind? Now they're going ahead of us, and we're having to go slower.
Yes, isn't that awful feeling to be held back like that?
Well, you know, I'm lucky enough that my parents are both very literate, and I did have pretty good teachers, and so, you know, I got over it pretty quick. But I could see how the kids who were in a group or two below the group that I got put in, that, well, forget it, they're never going to get into the Bears group, so why even try?
Right. And they once they start that sense of that feeling of defeat, it's really hard to convince them. When I teach 6th through 11th grade this year, 2 years I taught at a state university about 45 miles from my home and taught freshman remedial reading classes. And one of the first things I try to get across to all the students, whether they're 6th graders or whether they're college kids, is that your reading problem is not your fault. You know, forget the learning disabled label and throw it away and put teaching disabled there. Because learning disabled signifies to the child there's something wrong with the child. And most of the time, there's nothing wrong with the child. It's a teaching disability that was provided to the child through poor methods and poor structure, you know. The teachers, they believe the teacher colleges. They come out brainwashed. And I wrote one article on when I fault teachers. Because the young ones who come out of school, and that's all they've been taught by their colleges, they have nothing to measure that by. And I would be glad to help them, except my government school isn't interested in me being a mentor to a younger teacher or having a student teacher. A lot of the schools, they just do not want the outspoken older teachers who know how to do it to have anything to talk, you know, to discuss it with the younger ones.
Well, and all the new teachers have degrees just in teaching, not anything else, right?
Often. If in secondary education, you'll get more teachers who have a major in history. But in the elementary, it's often just a wide, blanketed certification.
What do you think about the argument that it's a matter of teacher pay? That, you know, as long as teachers are making $25,000 a year, you're only going to get people who aren't qualified to do anything else. Whereas if you go ahead and pay them 50 or 60, then the people who would be the best teachers will actually go and do the job instead of going out and making a better living doing something else.
I have seen instances where people switched from education when they would hear, well, you know, electrical engineer is going for 4 years of college, paying for 4 years of classes, and going out with $38,000 as a first salary. And I, as a teacher, I'll spend 4 years paying for 4 years of classes and go start at a $23,000 salary. And I think we've lost a lot of teachers that way. But then on the other hand, we look at the private and parochial schools who do not pay nearly as much as the public schools, and the teachers are highly motivated, function well as a team, and are seeking to do the best for the child. But the free market comes in there because they're seeking to do the best for the child, so the child wants to stay there. You don't want to drive away your clientele, and the public school has a lock on everything. You have no other choice unless you can afford to have a parent stop work and homeschool or afford a private or parochial school.
Well, and in fact, at a government school, as long as they're getting paid with tax money, the worse they do, the more money they get, instead of the better they do, like it would be in a private institution, right?
That's right, and the more special ed children you can create, the more expensive special ed classrooms you can provide. And different states have different pay formulas, but I have heard that some states give as much as double money for a special ed child.
Oh, nice. And this goes right to my next question. There's something that you wrote that just blew me away in one of these columns. I couldn't believe it. You said, excluding those, now everybody listen close to this, excluding those who are blind, deaf, or actually below normal intelligence, 10% of special ed kids ever get out. And I think you just answered the question of why that is.
It's true. Very, very few. In fact, my second article for Lou Rockwell was one I wrote called The Black Hole of Special Education. The children disappear into those black holes, rarely to be seen again. Regna Lee Wood, she's the research director for the National Right to Read Foundation, and she's in Oklahoma. She feels that as many as 99% of the children should not be in special ed.
99%?
Up to 99%.
So how do they get stuck in there in the first place? It's just a matter they got behind in math class, and
once
you get behind,
reading.
It's too hard to catch up, so off you go.
Right. And it's called then labeled a learning disability so that the blame falls on the child, not on the system. And once you get 2 years behind, well, you go in, it's a life sentence, because say that you did okay in math in first grade when it was a real easy stuff, and then second gets a bit harder, so then you start to drop behind. So they put you in the special class. Now, in some places, and I spent a year studying in England and spent some time in Israel and Holland, and they look at their special education classes that their mission is to teach faster than the other classes, so that you can get the child caught up to get the child back in with the regular group.
Oh, what a novel idea.
Yeah, isn't that neat?
Yeah.
Our schools put the child into a special class that slows it right down to very simple worksheets, very simple instruction. And my students say, Mrs. Taylor, I've been doing adding and subtracting every single year. We start multiplication, the school year ends, the textbooks are closed, and the next year the teacher starts over with adding and subtracting. So I end up with high school kids who still do not know fractions, cannot use a ruler, do not know how to do decimals. Many kids who still do not divide with any automaticity at all.
Wow.
And every year puts them then slower and back further and further behind.
Black
and
hole, that's exactly what
black
it is.
Black hole, it is. Just so few get out. And my mission is to get kids up and out of special ed. So I was standing outside my doorway the other morning for a couple, 3 minutes while the kids were getting into the room before the bell rang, and I counted 6 students go by who used to be in my reading class and don't need to be in special ed reading anymore. And it was a nice feeling to know that here in this one little tiny school, in 2 or 3 minutes, I can count 6 children who've gone out from my classroom. I don't know if any have ever left any of the other special ed classrooms due to being caught up type of thing.
Wow, well, so I wonder if that makes you a hero among the administrators or a cipher.
Ah, yeah, no, I'm not a hero. I am not a hero.
Hey, look, everybody, there goes the lady that kicked 6 kids out of her special ed class and back into their regular classes where they belong.
Right. And the my students, they're giving me a hard time because they're saying, Mrs. Taylor, I don't want to go. I don't want to leave your room. You're teaching Greek and Latin root words, and we just finished the Odyssey. Now they're reading the play Pygmalion. Next we're going to do a Shakespearean play. And they know that their reading level now is higher than many of the children in regular classes. And if they go into the regular classes, the level of education in some of the classes is going to drop for them. We have a new class called Contemporary Literature, and they're reading Sarah Plain and Tall, which is 5th grade reading level. high school contemporary literature class. My students say, we're reading at seventh grade level now. We don't want to go back and read a fifth grade book.
So what about the real smart kids? What happens to the kid who everything his teacher says sounds like something he already heard somewhere before, and he reads every assignment and gets done with it and makes A's on all his math tests? What's he supposed to do in a class where they're reading at a lower level than the special ed kids?
Where that smart child is reading lower?
What's he supposed to do when he's stuck in a class with a bunch of numbskulls?
Well, what I'm finding is that most of the students in my special ed kids classes are smart kids who are so frustrated, and once I get them reading, it just opens the world for them, and then they're angry at the years that they have sat in those classes being made to feel dumb. Then they find out when I teach them to read that they aren't dumb at all. So a lot of them become the behavior problems because they would rather the world perceive of them as choosing to be naughty than perceive of them as too stupid to learn to read.
Well, there's also a whole culture, especially in government schools, where the kids who are smart and study and make good grades are the nerds, and the people who are cool are the ones who barely get by. And so, like, all the pressure is against success, even just among the children.
Yes. Yes. That is too often the way. I also think that tracking the elimination of tracking has hurt our schools greatly.
What does that mean? What's tracking?
When I was in school, if you were planning to go to college, then you would go and you would pursue the courses leading towards college prep. And if you were thinking of business, you would pursue those classes. And if something, if your school was really difficult for you, you would be taking, a functional math class and functional English. Now they say, well, that's not fair to offer higher level classes to some of the kids and lower level to others. They need to all be in the same class. So they put them all in the same class. And I believe this has contributed greatly to America being dumbed down, because there's the teacher teaching this assortment from the boy who or girl who's going to become a physician to the one who probably just missed qualifying for special ed by 2 IQ points and assign a research paper. Well, the top 4% will do it. The middle group will maybe do a little shoddy job, and the bottom third won't even attempt it because they don't read or write well enough to even do an essay, let alone a research paper. So it has leveled everything down. They thought it would be models and it would encourage kids to go up. Instead, it's leveled education down. And so expectations become fewer and fewer with each passing year.
You mentioned before about all the worksheets that they do in school, and I'm trying to remember back. I believe that we always really liked the worksheets because they were always a lot easier than what the teacher would have been teaching us if they were actually teaching instead of just passing out worksheets. Where do those things come from? I mean, regardless of the fact, obviously the reason I liked them was because they weren't as hard to work, but why is it that, I mean, is this just some big central worksheet company that makes these stupid worksheets for all these schools, or what?
Well, about all those textbook companies have workbooks and worksheets in the big teacher manual that comes with the curriculum. They come from all over. You can go to Kmart and check it in their rows, and they'll have worksheets you can buy for your children.
Well, it just seems like the worksheets were always lower-level study than whatever it was that we were at that week, you know?
Right, and I almost never use worksheets in my room because I believe that the children deserve me standing there teaching them something rather than putting their egos on the line with either a worksheet that is offensive because it's so easy or destructive because they can't read it. But many, many do because they have all these different children in their room. They've not been taught how to teach reading, so they can just get to the core problem and get it taken care of. And so it's like it just kind of becomes worksheet heaven of, hey, let's keep these kids busy or else they're going to be behavior problems.
Okay, so George Bush and Teddy Kennedy a couple of years back signed this big thing called the No Child Left Behind Act with great fanfare.
Yes.
And I gather from reading your columns that you're not too big of a fan of the No Child Left Behind Act. And in fact, in one part you even write that we've given up 90% of the control of our schools to the feds. What exactly do you mean?
Schooling used to be a very local thing. In fact, my very first home I was brought home from the hospital was living in the old schoolhouse on the corner of my grandfather's property. And in that schoolhouse, and this is the type of schooling I want back in America, serve the people of that neighborhood. And those neighbors took turns being on the school board. You didn't do it because you wanted power and glory. You did it because it was your responsibility to be part of the neighborhood and help run the schools. And the schools were accountable to those people and to those taxpayers, and the parent who comes right to the teacher and says, excuse me, my kid's not reading, you better do something about it. Well, as they then consolidation started coming in, we used to have over 200,000 school districts in America. We now have 15,000 and a few, some change, and now we're going into another round of consolidation to have even fewer school districts and centralized power. So the more you centralize power, then the state starts throwing on all these laws on the school, and the feds throw all the laws, and then Teddy and George, they shook hands, which made me nervous enough to see those two agree on something.
Pray that for gridlock.
That sent up my radar right there of, hey, if this is something that Teddy will agree to, maybe Bush doesn't know what he's trying to get through here.
Oh, come on now, Mrs. Taylor. Where's your spirit of bipartisanship?
I lost it a while ago.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm not trying to throw you off track.
Okay. No, that's okay. And so the power keeps moving to the federal level instead of being at my grandfather's level, who used to serve on the school board. And I even have some of the school board notes from the one-room schoolhouse. And one of the school board members could not read, but he was not stupid, and he wanted better for his children, and he would sign the meeting notes with his ex. And I have his great-grandson in my classroom.
Wow.
So I think, you know, probably some things are inherited, or because a parent doesn't read, they don't read to a child, so they don't buy books, and then that child never sees a parent read, and it goes into a snowballing effect there. But now the local people have virtually no control over what happens in their school. It's all coming from the federal government. You must do this, you must do that, you must do that. And I read the other day that the cost for a school district to comply with the No Child Left Behind is going to be about $575 per child to comply. And by complying, the federal government will reimburse them $77.
Wonderful.
Some of these states are starting to fuss and opting out of it. I wish Michigan would join in that.
Yeah, I think they just granted a school district down in, I think, in San Antonio. Oh, well, okay, you got another year to comply since you're nowhere near compliance. Let's just put it off.
And I believe it's Virginia that's right on the verge of the, or maybe it's been accomplished already, the legislature voting, no, we're not going to do it. And you can't make us, because the Constitution does not give any rights to the federal government to have anything to do with the decisions in state schooling. So another way that they've overstepped the Constitution that was hopefully to protect us from this kind of stuff.
So you think there's a pretty strong correlation that federal involvement causes this dumbing down, like that since the feds have gotten involved is when the downward slide started, or was it before
that? Well, Retna Lee Wood, the reading specialist in Oklahoma, she says it started, the downfall began about 1929. Some people even date it prior to that. But the more that the Fed gets involved and the states get involved, instead of leaving it to the local people in their neighborhood to decide, number one, what they want for their children, number two, what they can afford for their children, then you have all of these other entities coming in with their different laws that cost the districts money, keep the districts from being effective with education because the money's going towards regulation and paperwork and extra secretaries and more superintendents and all of that instead of going towards proper training for teachers and work for the children. In World War II, the GIs going in all took this military entrance test. The level of illiteracy was 0.0001%.
Wow. 1941?
Yes.
Wow.
Korean War, the illiteracy rate was 17%. So those going into World War II, virtually everyone who had had any kind of little bit of schooling in the backwoods of Kentucky could read. Those going into the Korean War, 17% were illiterate by the military standards, which I think was fourth grade level.
And now here we are where half of the people who graduate high school can't read at all.
That's right.
50%.
Whole language started. In 1929, the professors started teaching at school in the universities. It takes a while for that to trickle on down. I have a definite memory of sitting in first grade with my teacher in the little one-room schoolhouse. I went to one-room school, and her talking to herself, she started to explain to us how to pronounce, how to sound out the word it. And then I remember her hearing her mumble, no, no, I'm not supposed to say teach that anymore. And I remember thinking, uh-oh, it must be bad to sound out words. And then it took me a long time to come around to thinking that, oh, no, that is the right way. Because she, I liked her so much that I thought, well, you know, she must be onto something here, and we're not supposed to sound out words. We are supposed to. English is written in a code. And when we read, and most schools of education never explain this to people, English, printed English is speech that's been recorded in a code. It's the greatest invention. They're about 2,500 to 3,500 years ago to invent that ability to say, well, I want to make, signify on paper, a B because this guy's buying 23 bunnies from me, and so I'm going to find a way to do it. And now, with the whole language, we don't give the kids the code. We don't teach them the secret. Those who happen to figure it out for themselves learn to read in spite of the instruction, and those who don't get it and see where that all fits together don't learn to read.
Well, there's got to be a certain, there must have been a certain level of backlash. I'm hearing, you know, a lot about the whole language method now, but I was in kindergarten, first grade, second grade in the early 1980s, and they taught us phonics, you know, sound it out. That's what they called it. Sound it out, one letter at a time, sound it out. So it must, the problem must have got better and then worse again? Or?
Yes, it did. There was, like you say, a big backlash from parents back when local people had more control. And so in the 70s, the schools returned to more of a methodical phonics instruction, and then the whole language came back in again. And what they do is they change vocabulary. So when I went to school in the 50s, it was called the look-say method. And then when people got wise to it, well, then they changed and started giving a bit of phonics again. But then the progressive people haul it right back into the same old thing relabeled called whole language.
Are they trying to make us stupid, or do they really believe in this garbage? I mean, it kind of seems to me like, you know, you sound it out. That's how it works. The letters represent sounds, you know? I mean, what's the point of this?
I believe that decisions were made many, many years ago to dumb down the American population.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Okay.
Who and how?
I would suggest that people read a book called The Underground History of American Education.
John Taylor Gatto.
John Taylor Gatto.
One of my favorite interviews.
And he also has a book called Dumbing Us Down. And he goes into how America being flooded with the immigrants coming in from Ireland and all over when the era of the immigrants coming in. And it was worrisome to the big guys, you know, owned Standard Oil and owned the big motor companies, that here were these energetic people in a new land who probably had some really great ideas, and if everybody's going to run around looking for capital to finance their wonderful inventions and their entrepreneurial spirit, that's going to keep these other guys from being able to have a market, corner on the market. And so Mr. Dewey, John Dewey, was very glad to help them organize a public school system that would basically dumb us all down so that we would become those dependable employees on the assembly line, turning out the products, buying them on time, and that it could be a command economy that just took things around and around and around, and the big guys would get richer and richer, the average Joe would become so dumbed down he wouldn't even question it. And yes, I think that it was initially started on purpose. I think there is a large segment of the educational community that continues it on purpose, and a large segment of the educational community that's been so dumbed down they don't even know to question what it is they're doing in the classroom.
I think there was something that you wrote in one of your columns about, I think this was yours, pardon me if I'm confusing you with something else I was reading, but I'm pretty sure this is one of yours, about how one of the results of the way the system is set up is to teach, or one of the reasons maybe, is to teach the kids, to show them just how unreasonable and untrustworthy each other are. So that if you suggest to someone that we live in a free society, they think back on their experience, and especially when they're still young, and the kids they knew in high school, and imagine these kids just acting in an unrestrained way. And so it's sort of, the state creates the conditions that make people so unruly that they turn to the state for more order.
Right. I didn't write that, but I agree with that. Is we're all, it's a way to manipulate and control, and to make it look like if we don't have Big Daddy tending us, then we would just become nothing but a bunch of animals, you know, stealing each other's food and breaking into each other's homes and grabbing blankets. And the more the state can get people who have not been educated, as the mind learns to read, it develops a logical thought process that then can think through problems to a solution. But when they haven't learned to read, they become very scattered. I believe ADD and ADHD, for the most part, are created in those classrooms in the first and second grade. And so who do they listen to? A 30-second commercial on who they should vote for. They go for the most colorful, the cutest, the whatever that's going to look to be the magical solution instead of thinking. I'm writing a paper right now that I'll be presenting at the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama on March 19th on a plan for getting rid of public schools and replacing them with free market alternatives.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's been interesting to be dealing with this. And right now I'm working on a part of it where I'm explaining that I was taught the pen is mightier than the sword. Well, that was true when Thomas Paine was writing. But the pen isn't mightier than the sword when we have the majority of our population who either can't read or choose not to read and sit in front of the government-led media TV and suck in everything that it gives out.
Right. Yeah, the pen might be mightier than the sword, but the TV is not mightier than airplanes with heat-seeking missiles.
Right.
So how do we fix it? Because that really is the big question, is the transition from here to there. I mean, if I had I Dream of Genie powers, then I would just erase all the government schools in America and say, all right, tough, everybody. You're going to have to figure out something. But since I don't have magical powers and these government schools are going to continue to exist for a while, how do we make the transition from the way it's set up now to a system of independent, privately run education?
Well, I'm not sure that I have the answer either, but I do have an idea that I'm putting into this paper that I'll be delivering. I think the schools are going to go down. I don't know how fast. Hopefully, within the next, 5 years, I would like to see and hope to see the government schools go down. I think that the more we have organizations like the separation of school and state, And we have the various church groups urging their population to get your kids out of the schools. Mr. Dobson, Reverend Dobson has done it, Laura Schlesinger, is to get the kids out. Now, the schools are dependent on the money. In our area, they get $6,700 a child, and we've been losing 48 and 49 kids a year out of a tiny school district. So that's big bucks. At some point, they can no longer hold doors open. And I would encourage that we start planning, because once they collapse, chaos is going to reign. But if we can plan ahead of time so that local people feel confident again to go back and set up little local schools just like we used to have. Someone told me the other day, said, well, you're in a very unique position because you grew up in a one-room schoolhouse. You know how they work. And you've lived through all these changes since the late 40s. And you know what it is we need to go back to. You can put into the words. Other people haven't lived it or experienced it and don't know how to put it into words. So that's what I'm trying to do, is to fashion an interim plan, because it's one thing to say we need to get rid of all the schools and have all free market schools. Right. Let's see how that can happen overnight. You know, let's close the public schools on Friday night and have free market ones open Monday morning. It isn't going to happen. We need an interim plan where communities have to have some help in planning schooling that they can handle during that time until our entrepreneurs can get themselves organized, get financing, and get schools open. Because when they collapse, we have about 40 million school children to take care of.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny because when you talk about, like, John Taylor Gatto has written a history of how it was basically the Rockefellers and the big industrialists who created these schools in order to, I guess in Gatto's words, create manageable people. Like you said, people who are good workers and pay their taxes and
don't get bored on the assembly line.
Yeah, exactly. But
right.
Now the problem is, though, is if we privatize it, I mean, there's obviously different models of doing it, but, you know, they have these things now that they call the Edison schools, where it's this giant for-profit corporation that basically just takes over old public schools and runs them basically the same way. And if there's any difference, it's probably that they're trying even harder to create manageable people for their future workforce rather than, you understand what I'm saying? I mean, I guess the state schools can pretend that they're disinterested as far as, you know, turning you into an employee. Whereas, you know, if we turn them over to giant corporations to be educated, then the giant corporations are just going to train them exactly how to fill those jobs later on.
Well, I'm sure that we'll have some of those schools that would be thinking along that line, but with a free market economy, that won't be your only choice. And if your child's in that school and that's what they're doing to your child, you will pull your child out and take the child down the road a mile and enroll them in a school that teaches independent thought, classical literature, Latin, all the things that I teach my son at my kitchen table.
Well, and also, you know, like you say, when they all collapse, when, you know, too many students leave and the schools just can't support themselves anymore and they fall apart, then people won't be forced to pay those exorbitant property taxes, and more people will be able to afford private alternatives. I mean, right now, there are people who, you know, I might be able to put my kid in government school, but the state's forcing me to pay for the neighbor kid's government school, so there's no way I can afford both.
That's right. When we are relieved of that burden of supporting this massive structure where superintendents get... One down by Detroit has been in trouble because his salary was $268,000 a year, and still he made an illegal corporation within his school system and was getting money skimming off that. So when we have all of these unethical people, the money that we're paying is not only exorbitant, it goes on for our lifetime. We never end. Where when we send our child to private school, we pay for 12 years of private school and kindergarten if we want it, and our debt is done. And we choose whether we're going to pay for a child's college or whether we have them work their way through college. But the way it's set up now is we never get the burden of school taxes off our back.
And you know what they say, but we have to educate everyone. I mean, gee, it behooves us to make sure that every kid in Texas has an education. So, yes, we do have to force you to pay property taxes, even if you don't have kids in school, because it's for the greater good, don't you know?
I know. Now, John Locke, he was along that line in Thomas Jefferson that it does behoove us to participate in some way in educating or training. It doesn't have to be a classical education. If Johnny is a fantastic mechanic and hates school, why force him to sit through 12 years of boredom when he could become a mechanic and be a functioning member of society quickly? You know, I think we're doing children a disservice to hold them into school for so many years, kids who just hate school. And if we were to take care of those types of things and not feel that everybody has to be exactly alike, because we aren't. And that's supposedly why America's, you know, is the land of the free, where you have the right to pursue the interests you have and not be forced into this government mold thing. We would not be in the dilemma we are in. I went back to class reunion. I graduated down in Ypsilanti, and it was interesting to see the kids who had gotten out of school and gone into Ford's Worthen factory. And then when those of us who went on to college were thinking, well, I don't know, that's a really good idea. I want to go to college. So we all end up at the class reunion. Well, here I am still teaching and still beating my head against a system that does not want to reform. And my friends who went to work for Ford, they're retired. They have retirement homes in Florida. Their homes are paid off in Michigan. They travel. I'm thinking, oh, dear, maybe I didn't make the right decision. So we need more freedom to let kids and help them do what they need to do. Are you aware that the Amish children only go to school through eighth grade?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they go, I think, first grade through eighth grade, and those would be the types of schools I would set up for someday when I'm queen, is the way my mom and I always put it. After eighth grade, their schooling ends and their apprenticeship begins, and they go with a man in an occupation that they're interested in, be that a window builder or a barn builder or someone who works with upholstery or whatever. But they marry late. They get out of school early, but they marry late. And so they have many, many years of work to learn a skill to save money, so when they get married, they're ready to support a wife. They have their skill. They have a nice savings. And in the 8 years in Army school, I'm sure the children come out far, far better educated than 75 to 90% of the kids coming out of 12 years of public school.
Yeah, no doubt about that. You know, you mentioned Jefferson earlier.
Yeah.
It's funny, I've read quite a bit of what he's written about education. In fact, I think, you know, he and John Adams hated each other for a long time, but then when they were old men, they kind of became friends again and started writing letters back and forth. And there's this one interesting debate going on between Jefferson and Adams about education, where, you know, Adams is basically taking the Hamiltonian view that, well, you kind of need a permanent moneyed aristocracy to hold up the state and to operate behind the scenes to keep it all going. Where Jefferson, the true believer in liberty, said, no, what we really need is not a natural-born moneyed aristocracy, but a natural-born aristocracy where any doofus has access to education and can become one of the leaders of the society, you know, whether in government or on the private level, to his own choosing. That,
right.
Rather than all this social engineering in order to place people in this position or in that position, that the purpose of education was to teach people how to learn, how to teach themselves, let them decide what they want to be when they grow up, when they turn 25 or something. But
that's right.
They ought to just be learning for learning's sake.
Right. It provides the foundation. I believe that schools need to provide the foundation, the reading and the writing and the math and spelling, and then encourage the kids to take it from there. Because if they have those skills, then they can do with them what their interest then lead them to do. And I See, I was reading it from Jefferson the other day that he looked to having the states divided, Virginia especially, divided into wards, like local school districts, and that everyone should have some part of supporting that, because if we, none of us support anything, we have children who will not grow up following the, you know, the founder's vision for the nation. And so I can see that, but I don't think we need to be forced to pay at the level that we're forced to pay. And I think if it's done at a local level where the teachers are eye-to-eye accountable with those parents and are held by the parents and the school board have the right to hire and fire and not always having to fight through all kinds of bureaucracies and things, that education will happen. We also need to get away from making people believe that you have to be a certified teacher in order to teach. This is silly. Look at the homeschooling children. They're winning the contest of spelling bees. They're winning the geography bees. My son, he's had 4 years of Latin. I don't know Latin. I teach some Latin roots and Greek roots to help with vocabulary. He's bought himself out of the book because he's told, get your Latin assignment done. And we have the key and we check his paper, but we don't know Latin. But because we've provided him with the foundational skills, he's able to carry on and do things like that.
Well, which of course is why they're trying to get rid of homeschooling by any end run that they can.
Oh, we make them look terrible. We make them look just awful. I heard that even Stanford in California, when they, a couple of years ago, they accepted a larger percentage of applications from homeschoolers than from the general population.
Well, I want to give an example from my own life of how a private education is better. I was one of those kids, I guess, who decided early on that I would rather be a misfit than do good in school. And I basically was on the verge of getting thrown out, would have just dropped out if I continued to go to government school. And lucky enough for me, my dad had saved up college money enough that he could afford to spend it on my high school. And I went to a little private high school in a little house just north of UT here in Austin. And it was quite expensive, but it was a little house, and you could cuss, and you could wear a hat, and you could smoke cigarettes, and you could call the teacher by their first name. And there were never more than six people in a class, usually four or five. And I got a great education, one that I definitely would not have gotten if I had stayed in government school. And although it was expensive, many of the teachers from that school actually quit and went and made a school of their own, based basically on the same model, only theirs is all non-profit. They get as many donations as they can, and they have a sliding scale for people who can't afford it. And, you know, they're mostly hippies and teach these kids why they ought to be socialists and whatever. But they also teach them critical thinking skills, and probably most of those kids will grow up to be too smart to be a socialist later in life.
Right.
And it's just, you know, it's all local. It's all controlled. Your teacher's name is Jane. And, you know, everybody gets along. It works so much better than this big chattel model thing where, you know, you have to, everybody walk on the right side of the hallway, and you can't wear a hat, and you have to be here and there by the time the bell rings twice, and, you know, all this arbitrary Prussian model garbage just thrown out, and it's just nothing but a teacher, a few students, and a topic.
Yeah, a friend of mine, who I've met through him writing in response to my articles, and so now we chatter back and forth, he has a friend who teaches in Arizona in a private school. And that gentleman says, learning happens within relationships. And I believe that's why my students do so well, is because we develop relationships in our classroom, and they know how much I care, and that my sole purpose is to get them to read. But our schools are set up that every time the bell rings, a relationship breaks, then they have to move on to a new class. And teacher changes, too big of classes, too little time to be with that teacher. You don't have those relationships grow, and then learning really is hurt by that. I used to teach at the deaf school in Colorado Springs, And it was interesting because the children lived there and went home on long weekends and for the summer. But they were still children, and they needed parents. And each year, certain little gals would choose me to be their adoptive mother for the year. And I'd be running off to school to buy barrettes for this one and doing this for that one because they needed something. And my other lady teacher friends, little girls would attach to them, and the men, boys would choose them to be dads. It was like we each had our own little flock that we herded. And learning happened best with those little flocks because we had that relationship there. And it speaks so well to homeschooling, because what better than to have your time with your parent? I wanted to be the homeschooling parent. That was kind of a little bit of a disappointment for me, but I don't want to stop teaching reading. And our son was going into middle school, and we decided to homeschool. And so my husband took early retirement and became the homeschooling parent. And it's been just wonderful because
the kids speak
guys,
Latin, for crying out loud.
Yeah, and my husband quit school the first week of 10th grade. So for these parents who think, oh, wait, I can't do it because I'm just not educated, I don't have, no. Hey, he quit the first week of 10th grade. They have their heads together over the same book, and they learn together. One reads the page, the other one reads the page. Then they discuss it. They learn it together. And it has been so wonderful for David to be with his father all day long. He has the best of role models. He's not into any of the baggy pants and tattoos and all that stuff. When school's done, they're in their garage repairing tractors, and right now it's snowmobile day, so they've just arrived home from the junkyards where they bought a million snowmobile parts. And so they are always constructively doing things together, father and son, so it really was better that it worked out this way, even though I envy them when I have to get up and go out in the cold and take off for work.
Yeah, but you still get the gratification of teaching all those kids that you don't really know.
Yeah.
They all get to learn to read, too.
I have some congressmen in Lansing have been trying to talk me into running for office. And we went down and met with them a couple times, and I finally said, I just can't. You know, where I am now, at the end of the school year, I can look back and say, 30 kids now read or read better because of me. And if I were in office, I could look back and say, I voted no on 30 pieces of lousy legislation, and it all passed anyway. And I'm sorry, I just can't live with that closure.
Oh, that's perfect. All right, we're all out of time. I want to thank you for coming on. This has been a great hour.
Thank you.
Everybody, Linda Schrock-Taylor. She writes for LouRockwell.com. She teaches special ed at government school and operates the Learning Clinic. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Philip. Bye-bye.
This is Radio Chaos, 95.9 FM.
One point in 1996, Jay Leno invited a number of high school students to be on his television program and asked them to complete famous quotations from major American documents, such as the Gettysburg Address, Declaration of Independence. Their response in each case was to stare at him blankly. As a kind of follow-up, on his show of June 3, 1999, Leno screened a video of interviews he had conducted a few days before at a university graduation ceremony. He did not identify the institution in question. He told his TV audience only that the students he had interviewed include graduate students as well as undergraduates. The group included men, women, and people of color. Leno posed 8 questions as follows. 1. Who designed the first American flag? Answers included Susan B. Anthony, who was born in 1820, and Betsy Ford. 2. What were the 13 colonies free from after the American Revolution? One student said the East Coast. Love that. 3. What was the Gettysburg Address? One student replied, an address to Getty. Another said, I don't know the exact address. 4. Who invented the light bulb? Answers included Thomas Jefferson. 5. What is 3 squared? One student said 27. Another said 6. What is the boiling point of water? Answers included 115 degrees Fahrenheit. 7. How long does it take the Earth to rotate once on its axis? The two answers Leno received here were light years, which is a measure of distance, not time, and, go figure this one out, 24 axes. 8. How many moons does the Earth have? The student question said she had taken astronomy a few years back and had gotten an A in the course, but that she couldn't remember the correct answer. How many moons does the Earth have? What would Galileo think? You know, he was dealing with four, you know. It is important to note that not a single student interviewed had the correct answer to any of these questions. Leno's comment on this pathetic debacle says it all. And the Chinese are stealing secrets from us? A 1998 survey by the National Constitution Center revealed that only 41% of American teenagers can name the three branches of government, but 59% can name the Three Stooges. Only 2% can name the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. 26% were unable to identify the Vice President. In the early 1990s, the National Assessment of Education Progress reported that 50% of 17-year-olds could not express 9 over 100 as a percentage, and nearly 50% couldn't place the Civil War in the correct half century. Data that the San Antonio Express News characterized as, quote, evidence of the steady lobotomizing of American culture. In another study of 17-year-olds, only 4% could read a bus schedule. Only 12% could arrange six common fractions in order of size. Ignorance of the most elementary scientific facts on the part of American adults is nothing less than breathtaking. In a survey conducted for the National Science Foundation in October 1995, 56% of those polled said electrons were larger than atoms. 63% said that the earliest human beings lived at the same time as the dinosaurs, a chronological era of more than 60 million years. 53% said the Earth revolves around the sun in either a day or a month. That is, only 47% understood that it takes a year for the Earth to get around the sun. And 91% were unable to state what a molecule was. A random telephone survey of more than 2,000 adults conducted by Northern Illinois University revealed that 21% believed that the sun revolved around the Earth, with an additional 7% saying that they didn't know which revolved around which. Of the 158 countries in the United Nations, the United States ranks 49th in literacy. Roughly 60% of the adult population has never read a book of any kind, and only 6% reads as much as a book a year, where book is defined to include harlequin romances and self-help novels. Something like 120 million adults are illiterate or read at no better than a fifth grade level.
They can be made to cheer for almost anything.